Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Soul Seekers podcast, where we believe that hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure as we share our mission of mentorship is conservation. To learn more about everything we do, check out our show on Carbon TV or go to soulseekersnation.com. Freedom on, everybody, and stay soulful. If you want to take your shooting experience to the next level, then check out Coltac gear for 100% made in America products. Coltac manufactures specialty gear designed for long-range shooting, hunting, and other tactical applications. From their support bags, suppressor covers, shooting mats, and a whole lot more, Coltac is creating tough, durable, and innovative gear for both civilian and professional markets. Go to Coltac.com to see all that they have to offer. That's Coltac.com. If you are looking to get a new rifle or build your own, look no further than Kelbley's. Kelbley's actions and rifles have a higher level of accuracy and hold 92 world records set on either one of their rifles or rifle actions. Whether you're looking for an ultralight mountain rifle or wanting to compete in precision rifle shooting, Kelbley's has you covered. Go to Kelbley.com to find out more or give them a call as their customer service is the best. That's Kelbley.com. Kelbley's. If you're looking to take your hunting to another level, there's no better way to do it than by subscribing to Onyx Hunt. If you want to get better at hunting and go deeper into your scouting, Onyx is the number one GPS app for that. Join the millions of hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. If you want to know more about Onyx, go to onyxmaps.com/hunt or download their app today for a free trial. If you are wanting to become more accurate and deadly with your shooting, one of the best things you can do is upgrade your trigger with a Timney. Timney triggers are 100% made in America and have been since their founding, providing a crisp, reliable, and repeatable trigger break every time. I'll be shooting Timney triggers in my guns this year, and I hope you'll join me in shooting the world's finest trigger. Go to TimneyTriggers.com to get yours today. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Soul Seekers Podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Mack. Today's episode is dedicated to all of you out there, whether you are brand new to hunting, an old salty veteran, or you are actually listening to this podcast with the idea of like, maybe hunting is something I want to get involved in. Maybe I want to give it a shot and experience it for myself. I've always had opinions, but opinions, well, they don't hold up to perspectives, and perspectives come through experiences. When you experience something firsthand, you really get to grasp and have an understanding of it and allows you to speak to it that much more. So today's episode is dedicated to International Hunter Education Association of USA, the IHEA, and we have the business director or the director of business development, Matt Clary, on, and he's going to be talking all about what IHEA is, what they do, and how they support all of us, as we might not even be aware that they're supporting us. So without further ado, Matt, my brother, how are you? Thanks for coming on the show.
Doing great, sir. Appreciate you having me on. And just so the folks out there know, IHEA, International Hunter Education Association. So that's a lot. That's a big mouthful. But yeah, IHEA is who we are. We're the Hunter Ed guys.
That's awesome. And IHEA is international, meaning this is just the USA chapter of IHEA, which is global.
Correct. Yeah. So obviously we're just in America, obviously, but we do work with a version of IHEA called IHEA World. And we do work with a few countries that are actually looking to us for some standards and trying to get more active in actually having safety training in their country. So South Africa is out there. Europe is bringing up their side of it. We've got some places down in South America that are talking to us. And of course, Canada, obviously, we've always been friends with Canada. But so we kind of lead the or take the torch, I guess you could say. But they definitely are coming up much better in the last few years and bringing their own kind of spice to it. So
yeah,
it's been great.
I love it. Well, it's really interesting. I was poking around on your guys' website, and I see you have standards. And being an educator, somebody who's been teaching for 19 years, I was a PE teacher, and we had national PE standards. Has is, does, know, when. You know, has the skill, knows how to use it, does it actively. No, you know, like, there's this stuff that we followed. But each individual state also had their standards and state standards that you had to teach to. Now, when we're talking about hunter education, there is kind of a broad, like, this is the benchmark of safety of what hunters need to know. Who came up with these standards? How did they come about?
Oh, gosh.
I'm putting you on the spot right there.
Yeah, right. I don't know the history of like who was the first one, but for sure, obviously back in the early 70s is when hunter education started coming about. Okay. So those standards IHEA came about and said, you know, we need to make this the same across the country instead of each state making up there, because the Northeastern guys are going to be a little different than the Northwestern guys and the Southeastern guys. So, yeah. Or girls, I'm sorry. But nonetheless, those standards need to be put there so that everybody's kind of on the level playing field, like you said. But at the same time, each state may have something a little bit more or a little bit different than what we've got, but it's still going to be that same standard. So everybody that's teaching what a muzzle is in Delaware is going to be the same thing to teach in California. But they may just say you got to be 10 years old to be able to hunt, or some other state you may be 12. So those things can change, but the actual what they're teaching them has to be the same.
Yeah. So I live in the state of Texas, but I took my hunter safety in the state of Washington. And mm-hmm. when I took my hunter safety, granted, I was 30 years old when I took hunter safety. So it doesn't seem like it was too long ago for me. But I remember there's real big thing like, make sure you close the gates behind you. Make sure you close the gates behind you. And I was like, man, I didn't know there's this many gates that people pass through. But at the same time, I was hunting public land, right? The idea of like national forests and just wilderness areas, and you're heading out on a trail where you're not crossing gates as much. Now I moved to Texas. I'm hunting a lease. I got two different gates on my lease, and I have to open that gate, drive through it, close that gate, and just it's repetitive over and over. And I've talked to the landowner before, and I was like, hey, you and I are together right now. There's no cattle on this lease. It's active cattle ranch. You know, am I okay to leave the gate open? And still, to that point, he was like, it's probably good practice just to close that gate behind you. And always, it makes me chuckle every time.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what we're talking about, responsibility and ethics right there. That's something that is like the first thing that you're taught first day in hunter education. And it's because we've got a sport and a tradition that we need to pass on,
right.
And we need to make sure we're careful with that. So the people that are out there that may be non-hunters, uh-huh. obviously, are the ones that we want to be careful with, because they could go either way, right? They could be an anti-hunter one day because of our attitudes or something that we do out in the field. So that's a huge one. And the one thing you touched on also, I wanted to kind of go back when you said you took your hunter ed in another state. That's reciprocity. We also deal with reciprocity. So just this last year, AFWA, which is American Fish and Wildlife Association, which is essentially represents all the fish and wildlife agencies across the country, signed the standard that says hunter education will be the same at every state. So that means if you take it in one state, you're good to go in another state. So that was kind of huge. It's always kind of been a handshake thing. It's like, yeah, we're going to teach it and everybody's going to be cool. But putting it into writing, have it signed by 50 states, which is actually a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Usually we can't agree on everything, but normally if it has to do with safety, it has to do with responsibility, and has to do with keeping this heritage going on for years and years and years, it definitely was a big deal.
So. Well, that's really interesting, because that's such a huge thing, especially if people listen to this podcast and know anything about politics. The whole idea of carry permits, which that's a whole topic within itself, whether people think it's constitutional or not constitutional. But, you know, I have a state of Washington concealed carry permit. Texas doesn't recognize it. Right. Mm-hmm. So like I go from state to state and only certain states will recognize it. And so it's very important to know that hunter safety translates. Also, to go hand in hand with that is I recently was at a Stewards of the Wild meeting down here in Texas. And it is an organization from like 20 to 40 year olds to create a social atmosphere, business networking centered around hunting. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. So I went and popped in on that, and they had a game warden speak. It was 2 weeks prior to the dove opener. And mm-hmm. so that game warden, he's talking to me, and he's like, the number one thing that we give tickets for is people not having proof of hunter safety. And I was like, well, isn't that just a part of you buying your hunting license? Because in order for me to get a hunting license in the state of Washington, I had to show proof that I took hunter safety course. And so when I came down to Texas, I just automatically, like, that's, you can't buy a hunting license without proof. Turns out that's not the case. And that is different state to state to state. And so I had to actually go back, find my hunter safety information, screenshot it, print it off, like, you know, laminate it and put it in my wallet, because I'm like, I'm not going to risk getting a ticket for what I would consider trivial. But then at the same time, states are selling licenses without checking for hunter safety, which that within itself really blew my mind.
Yeah. So it's kind of a funny thing. I don't know if we talked about this earlier, but I used to work in Tennessee for 25 years. I actually worked for Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency. So I was in hunter education. I was an officer. I did this for many years and then retired this past year and took this job with the IHEA. But nonetheless, that was one of the things in Tennessee. You did not have to have your hunter education to be able to buy a license. Reason being, they sell a combo license. So it was a combo hunting and fishing license. So it was a, you could go hunt small game or you could go fishing, just basic fishing license. So we didn't require the business, if they bought it from, like, say, Walmart or a sporting goods store, we didn't require them to be the law enforcement officer to actually check them. Now, so essentially we will sell you any license you want to buy, but if you get caught in the woods without your hunter ed, you possibly could get a ticket from a game warden. So there is some gray areas there in certain states, depending on what their law says. But yes, we definitely recommend taking hunter education before you even think about going hunting. I think it's kind of crazy. And I know you're laughing because it's just like, we tell people you've got to go drive a car before you can drive it on the road, right? You got to learn the rules, the right of ways and all the signals and all those things, because it's just normal, right? That's what we've made it.
Right.
But it's just not, for some reason, it's not in the brain right now that you're supposed to actually do that. Now that we're coming to this online only courses, obviously states have kind of gone to that since COVID. It's so much easier to take hunter ed now. You can actually go online, take your hunter ed, and go hunting the next day, essentially, if you want to, in some states. We've actually seen an increase in hunter ed graduates in the past 3 years. Just this past year, we had a little over 580,000 graduates across the country. And just 2 years prior to that, it was about 50,000 less. So we're actually getting more hunter ed graduates. But, and I'm wondering if it's because it's easier to get.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you can take it online, obviously. You don't have to go to a 4 or 5 night class and go shoot on a Saturday and all those things. But even though I believe, and this is just me because I'm old school hunter ed, I think those in-person classes are better than those online.
I would agree to the whole in-person thing being more beneficial to a new hunter, especially as an adult new hunter, right? Like, if you are somebody who doesn't have a father figure or grandpa or uncle or somebody older to be like, hey, listen, you're going to do this course, and I'm also going to keep my eye on you going out in the field and go through the shooting process and all that preparation. At the same time, it is very hard. And as an adult, someone who was 30 years old that was like, hey, I need to do this. It was a pain in the butt to schedule it and actually schedule that whole Saturday and block off that Saturday to go through the entire course. And then I did an online portion and then had to have a field course. And I did the online portion, paid for it, scheduled my field course, and then work came up. And I couldn't take that Saturday off. It ended up being too long of a lapse. I then had to go back in and retake the online exam and course all over again before I could. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the hassles that I experienced going through my hunter education. What are some of the things that you've experienced or you've heard stories of that barriers to entry? I mean, like, more or less.
Yeah, so that's kind of a touchy subject, obviously, from an old state employee. You know, sometimes we look at it and say, you know, it's part of it. We understand that we can't fit everybody's schedule. We can't schedule a class every Saturday or every Sunday or every time that somebody needs one. So, yes, some of those things are hard to do. But at the same time, we always stress, like, if you want to do this, and you want to be proficient and you want to be safe about it, you definitely got to go to a class, and you got to try to get in there. And I know sometimes it's tough with schedules and with kids and ball and practice and all the things. I mean, it's even harder to get kids into classes because they've got so many things that they're doing nowadays, you know? So it's definitely a thing that we listen to, and we try to do as much as we can to not make hunter education a barrier.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that people will do what they want, what they're passionate about. They'll do what they want. They'll do what they have to do to what they're passionate about, is what I'm trying to say.
If there's a will, there's a way, right? Like, people find a way to make it happen if they truly want it.
Yeah.
I agree.
And so there's other issues too that are coming up. You know, of course, I mentioned the online only courses, which usually should make that easier for people to take home hunter ed. But then also we're starting to learn that some of our instructors, so when we talk about volunteer instructors, they pretty much run the program in the States. Sometimes we've got really big associations that are actually very organized, and they have presidents and secretaries and all this stuff, and they really kind of run the program and work with the Fish and Game Department. But then we have some states that are totally run by the state, and then all the instructors are kind of under those coordinators that are out there in the field. And so we're kind of seeing a decline in the number of instructors we have. Kind of because back in the 70s and 80s, that was kind of the heyday of hunter ed, where they had the most classes, and it started to increase in the 90s and early 2000s. And then we started trying to see it going down a little bit. So those baby boomer instructors are starting to age out. We've got some, I had some instructors back in Tennessee that were getting close to 50 years in instructing. And that just blows my mind, to be a volunteer with the same program for 50 years.
Yeah.
That shows a huge amount of dedication. We don't see that as much anymore. We're actually working with some of the other NGOs and nonprofits, like the Council of Advanced Hunting and Shooting Sports, to put together something that can work with some of the younger folks that are that we want to be instructors. Some your age, some a little bit older and younger, but the millennial age to in the mid 30s is kind of who we're looking for. But my gosh, there's no way to get you guys out of the field with your kids or whatever you're doing. So it's hard to make them think about doing a week-long class from 6 to 9 every night, or a full Saturday and Sunday to do a full weekend class. So we're trying to figure out ways to kind of bring them in and be there and support them as much as we can. So it's been an interesting ride, and I think things are going to change within the next 5 years or so.
Yeah. And that is just that, to clarify, that is to certify hunter ed instructors, correct?
Sure. Yeah. Certifying them is number one, but then also just getting somebody to be a volunteer is tough.
Yeah.
To recruit volunteers, you know what I'm saying? So it's a different mindset nowadays. The younger people are a little bit different in their mindset. Like I said, those volunteers back in the day, they're like, they'll sign up and they'll say, yes, I will. Nowadays, it's like, yeah, I'll do it for a little bit, then I want to do something else next year. They don't stay, is kind of what we've been seeing. Yeah. So our instructor numbers are kind of going down. We've got around 31,600 right now. And we've lost maybe 1,000 or 2 in the last 2 or 3 years. So that's nationwide. So, and I think other states are kind of seeing that trend, and they're working as hard as they can to keep them, but it's tough. Volunteer retention is definitely a thing. And that's another thing that IHEA tries to do, is kind of help that. We broker deals with some of the big industries to try to get them deals on gear.
Yeah.
We've just hooked up a big one with GuideFitter this year, which was great. And we've actually pulled in some, this is mainly for our instructors and educators. We've actually pulled in NASP, National Archery in the Schools program. All those instructors get the same deals. And I just brokered a deal with USAA, which is USA Archery, which is kind of the Olympic side of archery. We got them looped in too, so they're getting those deals. So we really try to keep those instructors, because we know they are definitely a huge asset to all of these NGOs.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually brought in the National Archery in Schools program to the middle school in which I taught at. And
very cool.
And got certified and got all the other PE teachers certified, and the kids loved it. The interesting thing is the area in which I lived wasn't very pro hunting. And so, you know, we're shooting at just standard targets. And I'm like, you know, it'd be really awesome is having that be an elk, you know, shooting right behind that front shoulder. And some people are like, you can do that? Like, that's a real thing? And be like, yeah, can you believe that? And you actually can eat it also? And like, yeah,
Right.
applying it for the application in which, it's meant for, on top of just the recreation of it. It's mind-blowing how people live in a bubble, live with their head in the sand, live with ignorance to, the ways of the world. I don't know, it's really fascinating. And I have 19 years of public education under my belt, so I've seen a lot of perspectives and opinions and all that. Are
Oh, I'm
you
sure.
guys in charge of getting programs, hunters safety and hunter education in schools? So, outdoor ed in the local town here will certify you with hunter safety throughout the class. Is that a part of what IHEA is doing, or is that more on the state agency side?
Yeah, so good question. We're kind of the silent partner when it comes to those kinds of things in the state. So we'll support the state in any way if we need to, but it is kind of the state's job to go out there and find those instructors and help certify them and get them in the school. So yeah, if you have teachers that are interested in that, definitely give your local state agency a call and ask for the hunter education coordinator or administrator, and they should be able to get you hooked up with a class to get certified. But we definitely are there to help with that. So recently we started putting together an outline for instructor certification for online, an online course for instructor cert or a multitude of courses. We actually have an outdoor ELN, we call that. We have all these different courses in that we've made over the years and that we can share with anybody, any state that wants them. Those are freebies. Those are kind of like, here, put this in your little ELN, your LMS type thing. So we're working on putting some courses together where they can actually say, okay, we've got 10 new people that want to be certified. We're going to make you go into learnhunting.org. That's another little plug of ours. We've got to actually got a website called learnhunting.org for instructors. And they can go on there and take those courses. And then once they finish those courses, they'll go back to the state and say, all right, let's get the state specific stuff out of the way. That's not happened yet, but that's kind of the idea of what we're wanting to put together to help the states out. And then if there's any specific courses that we make for them, say they want to make their own certification LMS type thing, we'll help them with that. But then we'll probably put those in the ELN so everybody has a opportunity to utilize them. So yeah, we're kind of like we support, we help. We're not the ones going out there pushing it, but we're there to help if needed.
Okay, interesting. So
Yeah.
if I want to start diving in and I want to get certified to be a hunter ed instructor, do I need to go to a local chapter, a local state agency, or can I go to your guys' website and take a course? And then does it cost money or is it free, or what's that look like?
Right. Now you can go to our website or learnhunting.org website to check it out. And there are some courses there that you can take, but they're going to be courses that you might take after being certified. They're kind of like continuing education credits almost. But yeah, to get certified to start out with, you're definitely going to go to your state agency. They're going to obviously make you fill out an application. They're going to do a background check on you, I'm sure, which we help with that as well. We actually have a service that helps them save money on background checks if they don't already have a way to do that. But so yeah, so then you'll go to your state, apply, they'll vet you however they do that, and then you'll probably attend either a 3 or 4 day course to become certified. Then usually they'll make you go to a course or two with some other instructors to kind of get your feet wet before you actually put one on yourself. And then we always really push team teaching, obviously, because I may know a lot about archery, but my buddy knows a lot more about muzzleloaders. So, we definitely want to work together on that. Plus, it's just tough to know everything, right? And when I was an officer, at one time, I thought, man, I got to teach every single subject. It's like 12 subjects, and I don't know anything about first aid, but I know a lot about archery and rifles, So it's one of those things it just makes sense, right? And plus, the kids get bored looking at the same ugly mug for 2 hours. You got to put somebody else in front of them and let them listen. Make it a little more exciting, a little more interesting, that is. So yeah, I've been involved in a lot of in certifying a lot of instructors over the years, and it's very very amazing just to see those instructors go through the years and teaching thousands and thousands of kids. It's really amazing, And to what you said earlier, talking about, you know, how do we get more people involved in this? And if they could just mentor some of those or be mentored by some of those instructors, I think it'd be a cool thing too. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of my things is when I talk to a lot of people about hunting and on this podcast, talk about the different, you know, stages of a hunter, right? You get those first people mm-hmm. that just want to, you know, shoot their gun, see an animal, then they just want to notch their tags, and they want to hold out for a higher qualification species. Then they want to try different weapons, and then eventually you get that fifth stage, which is, you know, they don't even need to shoot an animal. They want to see other people shoot animals, and they want to give back, and that's finally, you know. But progression-wise, that's always on the tail end of somebody's journey, which, you know, maybe it lends to the fact that they're retired and they have a little bit more time, or they're not as bodily able to go out of field. My thing is that you don't have to know everything. You just have to know how powerful hunting is in a person's life and how life transforming it is. And mentorship and giving back and educating, it doesn't have to be a full-on course all at once. It's conversation, text message, checking in, teaching somebody how to use Onyx map software, you know, identifying what is a bedding area, transitions, like just small little things that over time, you know, add up. And that's one of my biggest struggles, is hunting is such an inherently selfish activity, right? We go out to fill tags for ourselves, and our families and community benefit from the food we provide. But if we're ultimately looking, it's like, I want to fill my tag, right? It's hard to take away our time, especially in, like, I guess more Western style hunting, where you get a tag and you got 2 weeks to fill it, versus, mm-hmm. you know, whitetail down here where archery season opened at the end of September and it runs all the way, you know, deer season to the middle of January. It's a lot easier to take people out and show them a time, but when that time is on the line, I find that to be challenging. What's your take, being from Tennessee, seeing it across the country and all that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a big question, but I want to go back to you talking about mentorships and making those connections, okay? I'm big into that, making connections with people, but then also teaching people how to connect to nature. And that may be a selfish thing, but I don't think hunting is very selfish. I'm gonna disagree with you.
I love it.
Because conservation is obviously not selfish at all, right? So conservation is huge. Yeah. And what hunters do makes a huge difference in what happens to our herds and to our, you know, what's going out there in every state. And if you don't think so, just look at a regulation book and tell me that these are complicated for a reason. So 100 years ago, it was like, you know, 5 pages long and said, you know, said like 6 things you had to make sure. And now it's like every single piece of ground, every single creek, stream, river has a different regulation, because we've made so many changes because of what we've done to the landscape.
Yeah.
Because we're here, obviously. I know a lot of people talk about that. Well, the animals were here before we were, and all these things. Yes, that's exactly why we have regulations, is because we've made changes to that. So when I talk about conservation, I always talk about connection, because if you're not connected with nature, you're not connected with the animals that you hunt, you're not going to get the same experience as somebody else is that just does it for fun.
Yeah.
You know, just does it to kill animals and then goes home. And that's why we teach hunter education, to teach that responsibility, not only to be safe and responsible out there in the woods, but also to be responsible to the game that you're hunting.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I really appreciate you challenging me on that, and I will adjust how I speak. No, I'm serious. I mean, a lot of people don't take feedback very well, and I want to always be on the positive side of hunting, and so I want to speak for it very positively. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I am going to then also bring something in topic-wise. Okay. You ever heard of the law of entropy?
Vaguely, yes.
Its law of entropy is often associated with the second law of thermodynamics. It states that in an isolated system, disorder tends to increase over time. So you take a 1970s muscle car, you leave it in a garage, don't touch it, door stays shut, and you come back and that car is not in good shape, you know, 50 years later. It just naturally decays. Things naturally decay.
Sure.
What is your take? And this is maybe a personal take. Maybe it's a scientific stance. You know, you don't speak for IHEA on this answer, but I've never actually asked a guest this question before. So it was interesting. Is when it comes to conservation and our defense thereof, and talking with anti-hunters or non-hunters, where it's like, well, if we just let nature do its thing, it would naturally balance out. But the law of entropy doesn't agree to that, right? And that's saying that if an isolated system, disorder tends to increase over time. What do you think about that?
That's a big question. And after you start talking about thermodynamics, I started having a little twitch from college physics is kind of what I thought you were going. But definitely a great question. And it's one of those questions that wildlife managers talk about every single year, because you really can't predict anything. You can just try it. It's kind of like wildlife management is definitely an art. Okay. There's science involved, but it is something that you have to try. I don't know how many wildlife managers I said, so what are you going to plant this year on the field, you know, out there at the WMA? He's like, I think we'll try this mix I put together. Like, what the mix got? And it's got like four or five different things. I said, well, how'd you figure that out? He goes, well, just over the years, I see what the deer are eating and they like it. I plant it. So it kind of makes sense. It's that kind of mentality that we have to understand that things change. Obviously, soils change, things change in the atmosphere. But yes, there's no way that we could let wildlife just kind of run rampant, because it would just, without our help anyways, because it's one of those things, like you said, yes, we'll have more animals possibly if we hunt less, and then they'll die off for other reasons, either be disease or starvation, or possibly running into cars and trains and different things. They're still going to pass away. Okay. And I can't argue with an anti-hunter about that, because they'll say, so you kill animals so they don't die. That's exactly what they'll say.
Right.
And I can't win that argument. And I say, you're right. We kill animals so they don't die a different way.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that I understand where you're coming from. I'll be honest with you, I lived with two vegans for a long time. They didn't believe in killing animals. They didn't believe in eating meat. And I was the cook. Can you imagine? I'm cooking venison over here and I'm cooking tofu over here. So I learned a lot in those 10 years, I think it was 10, 12 years that I did that. But nonetheless, it's a mentality that you look at. So everybody's going to be different on what they think, what they believe in, how they appreciate nature, how they appreciate wildlife in different ways. When I was young, I've not told this story to too many, but I think it's makes a pretty good point right here. There was a time in my life when I was about 12 or 13, very, very sensitive time where hunting is okay for kids. So they're either gonna or they're not gonna.
Yeah.
My parents split up at that time. So my dad was the hunter, obviously. And so I went hunting with him all the time, and we could always talk about the social aspect of hunting as well. But nonetheless, when he left, there was less hunting. Okay. I hunted with him on the weekends or every other weekend or whatever it was. But my mother was like, if you don't kill deer, I'll buy you a really expensive camera. And if you could shoot them with a camera instead of a bow, she put that in my mind. I was like, man, I could get a really nice camera. I could take cool pictures. And I was like, but then I can't hunt.
Yeah.
So I was put in a really weird predicament at that young age. And so for about 3 or 4 years, I didn't do either. I didn't take pictures and I didn't hunt. And I kind of went through a transition phase. And then once I got a little older, I started understanding the importance of hunting. And then also that I had this feeling in my soul. This is what I'm supposed to do. It's almost like you hit that switch and you're like, oh, I'm a human. I'm supposed to actually kill animals to eat.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily just have to go to the store and find it in a package or at a McDonald's that's sitting in a bun that's ready to go. People just don't understand that, like you said earlier, you know, you can actually kill animals and eat them? Like, yeah, that's kind of what hunting is all about. But we have to make it sound like this pretty picture and this wonderful thing, when in reality, it's a very serious, serious responsibility that we all have to really think about and really pass on to people, because it, once you lose it, I think it's one of those things that's really hard to get back. Mm-hmm. And, but once you figure it out and you feel that, like you're talking this life transformation, you really do. It's kind of like some switch turns on in your brain and it says, this is who I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
Some people don't get it and they can't do it. And it's just really, really weird to them.
Yep.
But in, when you're, you, when you get used to it and you kind of get out there and you start doing, you understand the reality of it. And it's not about the best bow and the coolest camo and all those things. It's about that connection with that animal and how blessed you are to be able to harvest an animal like that and take it home. So, yeah, it's a whole thing for me. And I'm glad you brought it up, because it's more than just conservation and hunter education. This is stuff that just gets you ready to go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But once you get out there and start experiencing those things and really understanding why you're out there and what you were bred to do, I think is in reality, it's not to kill things. It's to be a human. This is just part of being human to me.
Yeah, I would agree. I love that. I have a lot of different talking points I'm going to be bringing up here, and it all goes right hand in hand with this. To segue with it is, I don't remember Pittman-Robertson Act really being talked about in my hunter safety. Now, maybe I got overwhelmed with information at 30 years old and never really like being taught gun safety or any of that. Did I miss something in my hunter safety, or was it not much of an emphasis prior to a certain time? Do you know much about that?
It's something that you should have been taught. And it probably was just one question. It was like, where do state agencies get their funding? And that's pretty much all you had to be taught. That's a standard.
Yeah.
We at least has to be put out there and say, who pays the state agencies other than hunt and fish licenses, obviously. Pittman Robinson, PR money. That is taxes that's put on hunting and fishing gear or hunting gear. That is got brought back to the states, depending on their population, how many hunters, their land mass. There's a formula there, obviously, that they put together, and you get so much money a year, depending on how it went that year, obviously. And then the states can use that money to put towards wildlife management, hunter education, ranges. A lot of people don't know that wildlife agencies actually normally fund and manage the ranges that are in your state. Hmm. So that's a big deal. And because obviously people love guns in the United States. I hate to say it.
I love it. I think it's awesome.
Well, in this day and age, sometimes it's hard to say it because there's so much flack about guns. It's just a huge thing. But they do love guns here and they like to shoot. So actually shooters and gun owners actually put more money into the system than hunters do right now, which is kind of crazy to think about. But when I was an R3 coordinator in Tennessee, that was one of the things I was doing, was I was putting more money into our ranges to increase that. And then also trying to pull people into those ranges, because what's a firearm owner? They already know how to shoot, right? They already know how to do those kinds of things. And they're safe, obviously, because they're coming to ranges and shooting. Why don't we talk to them about hunting? And that was one of the things I was going to bring up, is like, it's changed. It's changed from, so what do you think about hunting? Now it's, so have you heard about hunting? It's a totally different question, because it's relevant now. There's so many people that have never even heard about hunting, never would even think about it. Why? Because they were never taught. Obviously, I was talking about going to the store. It's so much easier to get meat nowadays. I mean, you can get fish from all over the world, meat from anywhere you can think of. It can be freeze-dried or frozen and sent to your door. How easy is that? But it's a little harder to go kill a deer, process it, put it in your freezer. It's definitely a little harder. But man, is it so much more worth it, and it's so much better. But yes, I definitely understand what you're talking about here, and it's one of those things we definitely have to keep in the conversation.
Yeah, I am developing a seminar talk that I'll be presenting this February at the Mule Deer Foundation Hunt Expo in Salt Lake City, and it's how to talk about hunting and why it's important, right? Mm. And I'm going to be presenting this seminar to a lot of hunters.
which, okay. You know, a hunter is already like, what do you mean I hunt? Like, it's like, yeah, but do you know how to talk about hunting? And also, do you know why it's important? And, you know, I have quite a few questions that I lead up, but my very last slide on the presentation is not everyone needs to hunt, but everyone needs to support hunting.
Exactly.
And that stems from three things. First is credibility. Continue to be an upstanding, trustworthy individual of high character that knows the facts and truth about hunting. Second one is emotion. Use anecdotal evidence. Anecdotal, meaning I experienced this so I can speak about it, right? Like, you know, let's go all weird for you. I don't know the earth is round. I've never actually seen with my own eyes that the earth is round. I just have been told from people down the line, generations and generations, the earth is round. So anecdotal evidence is use our own personal experiences to convey care towards wildlife and universal values that resonate with non-hunters. And lastly, logic, because you got to connect with the heart and the mind in order to win people over to support hunting, is use the power of words and conservation facts to solidify why hunting is important and its positive impact on wildlife. So, because a lot of people hunt, doesn't mean they know how to talk about it. Doesn't mean they know how to defend it. Doesn't mean they know how to be an ambassador for it, when each and every one of us are already. The moment we sign up and we buy that hunting license, we're an ambassador for hunting.
And that's perfect. That slide is perfect. And I've had the exact same experiences teaching hunter education for so many years. There was always a small percentage of people that were in the classes. And when I talked about responsibility and ethics, of course, even if I wasn't teaching a class, I'd show up to a class in my uniform. And I would talk about that because it was very important to me. And it's exactly what you're hitting on. And so I would sit up there and say, so do you guys think that you should buy that t-shirt down at Walmart that says happiness is a warm gut pile and wear it to school? And a couple of them, of course, would laugh, and the dad in the back would get real mad and cross his arms and start getting upset with me. And I'm like, I've actually got his attention now. There's a reason we don't want to be that in that light, because like I said before, those non-hunters see that and they think, oh my gosh, that's just, we don't even want to be around this type of person. Right. And if that's what hunters are, I don't want to be a part of that. And then when they see a bill come by that says, you know, we're going to increase hunting in your area. Nope. Negative. I don't want those type of people in here. Same thing happens. You probably heard this before. After you get done hunting, you may have cleaned a deer. You stop at the gas station, you go inside to get a drink, and you've got blood all over you. Who wants to see? Nobody wants to see that. Other hunters, yeah, it's fine. We understand. It's part of life, right?
Yeah.
But those non-hunters and those anti-hunters, it's just fuel for a disaster. So it's perfect that those kinds of things are perfect to talk about hunters, so that way they understand that not only is it a right, obviously, just for some people to hunt, but it really is something that can be taken away. It's not a right. It's something that can be taken away. It's a privilege, and we need to understand that always can be taken away. We see it every day.
And I'm going to disagree with you right there. I don't think it's a privilege. I believe hunting is a right. The ability to self-procure food for yourself and feed yourself is a human right. And whether or not we want to, and this goes into the perspectives and opinions of it, I have the ability to feed myself. Whether or not I want to play by the rules of what governments and agencies and all that stuff. So we, as ethical and legal, moral people, we play by the rules because we are good and decent humans. And at the same time, I to say hunting isn't a right and it's a privilege, I'm like, ooh. I disagree with that. I disagree.
Well,
with that.
Yeah. And it's been talked about for many years. It's happened in every state. There was a time there about 10 years ago when everybody was passing those laws. It's a right to hunt here. It's a right to hunt here. And innately it is. But obviously there's a reason why we have these rules. Why it's part of conservation. It's part of keeping things in order in a way. But then also that way, obviously bag limits, those kinds of things. We've got to talk about those things because we want to make sure that there's enough for everybody to share. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Nowadays there is pretty much, I mean, I don't know too many states that they're just like, decreasing in populations, but if we just increase those bag limits every year, things are going to change and it's going to be different.
Yeah.
So when I say that, I understand what you're saying, but I think you understand what I'm saying as well, that it is a privilege, because if we break those rules of engagement per se, it could possibly be taken away and say, we can't do it anymore because we've taken too many, or we've done this wrong, or we've got too many subdivisions, or whatever it is, the rule that we're breaking.
Yeah.
Things change.
Now, I also come from the state of Washington, which their Board of Wildlife has been absolutely hijacked. And so I come with the perspective of, just because it's a state agency or, you know, assigned, doesn't mean that they're for hunting. And so I don't stand in the middle. I stand with perspective of, like, I know what it's like when the wrong people are in place of power, taking away my season for spring bear, which I was building points and points and points season after season. And yet you can still shoot two bears a year, but we can't hunt them in the springtime. Like, there is all sorts of shenanigans when it comes to that. And that lawsuits are still going on in court right now. And so it's really interesting. I will say, though, and we'll shift gears off of this, because there will be an agree to disagree kind of moment. And this is a part of whether or not you and I agree or disagree or whatever, that we're being cordial, that we can actually have discussion, right? Charlie Kirk just got shot a couple weeks ago, and his big thing was, when discussion ends, violence occurs, right? And when people are shutting others down and being like, I don't even want to hear your side, that's when anger happens and all that. So going back to your point about, like, you know, going to the gas station and blood on your clothes and different stuff like that, content without context is a dangerous thing. We always, and that's why we need to learn how to talk about hunting. And we need to, you know, I don't want to walk on eggshells. I don't want to live in a world where I have to walk on eggshells. And I also believe in being able to discuss with people, like, hey, this is why I look this way, or this is what I'm doing. Did you know it's hunting season? Matt, this is a story I've shared on the podcast multiple times, but in the state of Washington, I was a high school football coach. That football started August 16th, and the first 2 weeks of August was black bear season opened up. And I'd always go backpacking. I used to work at REI. I have a little on the granola side in me, you know. But at the same time, I'm a red-blooded Second Amendment believer, like, you know, like Gandalf, thou shalt not pass. This is it, baby. This is my line in the sand. I was wearing camouflage 9 miles in the backcountry, and I had 3 day hikers roll up with their dog. One of them was a female, two were males, and they were like, "Yeah, what are you doing? You're wearing camouflage." I was like, "Yeah, we're hunting." "What? You're hunting? What, you can hunt?" Like, "Yeah." "Well, what are you hunting?" "Black bears." "Bears? You can hunt bears? Wait, there's bears here?" And and it was just a craziest interaction that really resonated with me, and it's impacted me to this point in my life, where from the get-go, I had to instantly talk to other people that had no clue about hunting.
Yeah.
And whether you're taking hunter safety in a rural community in the Midwest, where hunting is just a part of the way of life, is a lot different than when you're taking hunter's ed in an urban environment where, you know, the grocery store is two blocks down the street, and you have, you know, what, Meals on Wheels or DoorDash, whatever you call it. Like, you know, you can order stuff to your home. So I think these are the conversations that need to be had, is that hunting looks completely different in all different areas of the nation, across the world, and we're all in it together. So let's figure out how we can support each other. How do we give back? Maybe it is by financially in Pittman Robertson, or joining a critter club, or NRA, or Second Amendment Foundation, or supporting IHEA, or, you know, whatever this is. Or maybe it's, you want to give back by your time, and you want to become a hunter's ed instructor, and you want to impact lives on that forefront. But whatever we do, we need to always be giving back into hunting.
Sure. Totally agree with you. It's a great way to say it.
Man, I love it. This is a good This is a great conversation. I love it. It's reminded me of The Last Samurai, where Tom Cruise and the leaders. This is a very good conversation. Cracking me up. Okay, no, it's so good stuff. Is IHEA, you know, you go into the website, you have a membership thing. It's a nonprofit, yeah. Right? So, like, people can become members and support even if they're not hunter instructors, hunter ed instructors?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Obviously, we have a lot of benefits for members. It's $20 a year. It's not very expensive. A lot of discounts, a lot of, obviously, the LMS I talked about with the Learn Hunting side of it. There's also some USAA benefits with the archery, so with United States Archery. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some benefits there for them. And then also you're supporting IHEA in their efforts to do great things across the country. So that's kind of what we're known for. So it's been a great ride already. Like I said, I've only been here for about 8 months and I've already learned so much, and I'm impacting things across the country instead of just in the state, which is really, really cool. But yeah, time is definitely a thing that is hard to get from people. So being an instructor sometimes could be tough, but I definitely, and I'm still trying to get my uncle to do it. He's 7 years old. He's starting to slow down in his hunting, but he still goes, he's still trying to climb trees at 70 and shoot some wily deer in Michigan. But I keep telling him, man, you've got so much knowledge and from just the years of experience. He said, I don't know how to teach that. I said, it doesn't matter. You know how to shoot a bow. You take that for granted. You know how to shoot a gun. You know how to clean a deer. All those things are very important to pass on to our next generation. And I really do wish that and hope that people that hear this get motivated about that and say, you know, I should give back, because you know what? Deer camp can't happen without people. And so those are the things that I always try to instill in people and say, you know, not everybody at deer camp's a hunter either. Some people just come to cook. Some people could just come to hang out with the guys. But in reality, there's a reason for that. And that's that social aspect I talked about earlier, that I think hunting definitely still needs to be a social thing, even though some people could do it by themselves. It does take a group of people to bring people up to hunting. So
yeah,
I do believe that.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Your YouTube channel is... Mm-hmm. Is something I
want. Hunters Connect.
Yeah. So Hunters Connect.
Yep.
Which is, so if you search Hunters Connect on YouTube, you'll come across the channel IHEA-USA and then quotations Hunters Connect.
Mm-hmm.
I've not gone through all your different videos that you have on your YouTube channel, but what is a lot of topics that people can find if they want to go there?
Yeah. So thanks for bringing that up. That's actually something that we're pushing right now during hunting season, trying to put at least one or two posts a month about it, because there's great information, everything from intro to hunting to advanced hunting skills, you know, whether it be how to pick the right scope, how to sight in your rifle, how to, you know, clean game per se, mm-hmm. how to get your survival pack or your first aid pack to put together before you hit the woods. So there's just all kinds of information. And there's lots of people on there that have put a lot of time and money to those videos that have helped us produce those over the years. Just in the past 3 or 4 years, actually, is when those got produced. So they're very relevant. They're very new. There's some familiar faces on there for sure in the hunting industry. So definitely check it out. It's something. Hit that subscribe button. It'll help IHEA out, and also you'll get to see anything new that pops up in the near future.
How often do videos get released on that channel? Is it getting to the point where, you know, once a month you might see a new video, or is it just when people are willing to donate their time and put something together?
So I think 23 or 24, maybe the beginning of 24 was one of the last videos that were posted, and it really kind of comes down to money. And who can support those videos. Mm-hmm. Costs a lot of money to produce a video and post it. We got to have guns. We got to have ammo. We got to have bows, lots of gear. So it takes a little bit of time and money. And this year we didn't produce any this year because we felt like we did so many in the past 3 or 4 years that we had quite a few in there.
Yeah.
And then obviously that funding is part of it. We're really trying to, since I've came on, we've kind of been changing our focus on our social media, obviously. We actually just started a instructor advisory committee video campaign. So we actually have people that are in charge of the volunteers across the country, and there are different regions. There's four regions across the state or across the country, and they're kind of over their region, and they help support those volunteers through for the IHEA. Well, we came to them this summer and said, hey, we'd like to do a video campaign with you guys. And actually, I want to see you all in the videos. Mm-hmm. I don't want to produce a video with some person they don't know talking about how to put their harness on. I want you guys to do it. And I want you to tell us that story, because you're the lifeline of this whole thing. So that's where we started. And we just got 17 people picked. They're going to start producing these video or making these videos, sending them in. We're going to kind of edit them, and then we're going to start putting them on our social media and using them at certain times of the year. So I'm really excited about that, because I feel like we are the people to give those instructors voices, because sometimes they're very quiet and they're very humble.
Yeah.
And which is cool, until a point where we want them to actually say some things to get out there instead of just in their classes. We want to broadcast them across the country and say, thank you.
Right.
And I appreciate them. I still can't get, I worked for the agency for 25 years, and now I work for Hunter Education Association. I'm still getting paid to do this, which is amazing, but I still can't understand how you could do it for so long and not get paid, which is another amazing thing that a volunteer is. And I still haven't figured that out, but I get it. Once you're in it, you're in it. And there's a reason why they're there. And if you ask them that, they'll tell you a really cool story why they're there. It could be somebody got hurt one time with a gun. It could be they got hurt themselves. It could have been just their whole family's been involved in hunting for so long. It's given back to them. They want to give back to the sport.
Yep.
So it's really cool to see the different type of people that are involved in that. So, yeah.
I love that. I always say on the podcast, you can never outgive good. Sometimes you just got to put good out into the world and do it not because you expect anything in return, but just because it's just the right thing to do. And so all your volunteers and all the hunter safety people out there, we want to thank you. Those of you who are listening to this podcast and those of you who are not yet an instructor, but thinking about maybe getting into it, don't be afraid to, right? Like I understand in a day and age of financial pressure and squeeze, like inflation is killing it right now on families. And my wife and I are still, you know, trying to figure out different ways to make ends meet and make sure things keep going, that it's hard to take time away from all the stresses to then donate it to something else. But you can never outgive good. And when you put your time and energy into it, it's not going to go to waste. There's always some sort of universal law of return that will boomerang back to you at some point, sometime when you least expect it. It's just, you know, live by good and it naturally comes around. So I appreciate it, Matt. What other things have we not hit that you feel like we need to touch on before we wrap this up?
Oh gosh, we've hit a lot of good things, I think. But yeah, I mean, just check us out online, obviously. Check our website out, our learnhunting.org page. We try to pull people into that. That's really kind of what we push a lot, because education is the key, obviously. And if we can get enough people in there looking at it, it's also a mentoring site. I didn't mention that earlier, but if you're an instructor, when you apply or when you go in and put your credentials in, like your name and all those things, we actually put you in a silent background check. And if you don't make that cut, you don't get to go on that site. I know it's tough, but we got to be careful nowadays, right?
Yeah.
So we actually put you through a background check. It doesn't say that, but we actually do. And once you get vetted, you're in the site. And there's also a part for students to come on there as well. Not kids, but students, adult students. They can go on there and they can find a mentor if they need somebody to talk to, give some advice possibly. Hey, how do you hunt this? What time of year do you do this? What do you use for a bow, whatever it is that they got questions about, they can do that on there. So that's something we like. I know you talked about mentorship before this podcast, man, we're all about it. We definitely, mentorship is a social aspect of hunting. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's bringing somebody up, teaching them the ways, at least giving them a little bit of a push before they go out there on their own. So definitely check out learnhunting.org, check out Hunters Connect. I think it's going to be a huge asset to your hunting. Even if you're a seasoned hunter or a brand new hunter, it's definitely going to help you out.
I love it. Yeah, I was just popping around to some of the different videos. Video that has a lot of views, how to pluck a duck. I mean, logical, it makes sense. How to European skull, or how to clean a deer skull for a European mount. Mm-hmm. you know, a lot of field to plate type, you know, things. But then also what I love, setting flat set traps, how to trap, how to hit more mm-hmm. upland birds, shooting positions, proper rifle fit. I mean, there's a lot of phenomenal stuff on here. I think that, mm-hmm. that's awesome and a great resource that's free. I always like to, you know, share the YouTube University, right? Like you can be a graduate student just through going to YouTube and learning as much as possible.
Sure, sure. I mean, obviously there's a lot of content out there. There's content everywhere. Everybody's putting something out on TikTok and YouTube and everything, but the stuff that you find that's actually from an accredited education association, from people that actually know what they're talking about, this is where you want to go.
Yeah.
You can listen to anybody online, obviously some big time hunter that's in front of a camera all the time. Obviously they're going to seem like they know everything, but sometimes they don't. So definitely come back to the education side of it. It might be a little bit more boring and not as exciting as some of those hunting shows, but you're gonna get the right information for what you're gonna be doing.
Well, there's a difference between entertainment and education.
Sure.
Right. They sure. can be both. Right. They can be both. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes you just need to get to the brass tacks of learning something. So exactly. I really appreciate it, Matt. Thank you so much for coming on, sharing your wisdom, your passion, and your love for the outdoors sure. and hunting. It's really exciting to get to sit down and have some dedicated time to talk with you, build that social aspect of it. One thing before we wrap up, I want to bring up on the website, you guys do a conference. You do a hunters conference. What is that? Yeah. And is it open to the public for anyone to show up to?
Yeah, so not necessarily open to the public. It's designed to be a time where all the state hunter education administrators, the range coordinators, and then volunteers also can come to this conference. We also have a lot of vendors that show up that are support hunter education, like you talked about, some of the online hunter education vendors that are out there, some of the range vendors that are out there, and then also the big industry guys, the rifle, the guns, the bows, some of those vendors are there as well. They're there to support ITA, and they're also there to help support the states as well. So that's pretty much what it's designed for. We come together for 3 or 4 days, learn a lot of good stuff. Obviously that camaraderie, social aspect part of it comes together. Mm-hmm. We learn from each other. We meet some people we may not have met. We meet people from Alaska to Maine to all over the place, and we learn something new. So I think it's key to kind of bring everybody together and kind of see what we're doing across the country and you know, kind of understand where we're coming from, because some states obviously are a little bit different, you know, yeah. than others when it comes to what they think hunter education, you know, how it's taught, what age it's taught at. So yeah, that's mainly what. Who it's for is those people that are working for hunter education across the country.
I love it. And then to anybody who's ever gone to some sort of camp in their life, there is mm-hmm. a thing called a camp high, right? Like you leave camp sure. and you're energized and you're like, I can't wait yeah. to make a difference. I can't wait to set a mm-hmm. tone. And you return back to where you go and you get to carry on that torch and you get to just exactly. Fan that flame and get it burning brighter and hotter and just like, you know, it only takes a spark to start a fire and this whole world's ablaze. So, you know, that's big time. That's awesome. So those of you who are thinking about becoming hunter ed instructors or you are currently, that's something that you can go get involved in and start making a difference. I will say also is when I got into hunting and I started my platform and podcast and all this, I didn't know anyone that hunted. But it was when I start to put myself out there and to do things that were at first uncomfortable and unfamiliar and challenge my courage that led to me then having so many different opportunities of hunting across all over the place, right? And so mm-hmm. like what you're saying, it's different agencies and different states come together. It's like, man, hey, you want to know somebody who hunts in Alaska? And you might have an easier way to get up there. You never know what type of networking is going to take place when you all come together for a common cause.
Sure, so. Sure, exactly. And I will make a point too. Obviously, if you want to physically come to the conference, you can. It's in Glendale, Arizona, next June. But we also offer this free to any instructor that wants to be, that wants to watch it online. So we actually broadcast the whole conference. Any of the sessions will all be online. So any instructor that wants to sit at home, if they don't have time or the money to travel, obviously, we offer that free to every instructor.
I love that. Cool. Love that. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Matt. Really appreciate you coming on, talking about IHEA and all the things you got going on there. Guys, if you have ever thought about giving back to hunting more than what you do, whether it's financially or mentoring or whatever, and you want to get involved in hunter education, go check them out, IHEA-USA.org, or go to, what is it, learnhunting.org.
Learnhunting.org.
Go do that. Go figure out, dive deeper into your hunting roots. Dive deeper into your passion. And one of the things that I know from this idea of mentorship as conservation that we push here at Soul Seekers Podcast is that you will only know hunting that much more when you teach it to others, right? As a school teacher, I know that a student reaches a level of mastery when they can reteach that topic or subject to somebody else, to another classmate, right? Hey, how do I shoot a basketball? Okay, bend the knees, elbow in, extend up, follow through, right? When that student can reteach that to another person, they've reached a level of mastery. You want to become a better hunter? Learn how to teach it to other people. And that will only allow you to grow deeper and build your foundation that much more. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Soul Seekers Podcast. I'm Johnny Mack and Matt Clary at IHEA. Be blessed. Know that life is happening for you. It's not happening to you. No victims in this world. And that we get to create the existence that we want each and every day with our thoughts and how we show up in this world. Be blessed. Freedom on. Thank you so much. God bless. Good luck hunting this year. And as always, stay soulful. If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to support the show, you can always like, share, subscribe, and leave a rating as it helps us share our mission of mentorship is conservation. Thank you so much for tuning in and being a part of Soul Seekers Nation as we transform lives through primal adventure.